During the coronavirus pandemic panic, all the big stores were left open for business, while all the mom and pops were forced to shut down. At least, so it seemed. And that leads us to ask today, how does a big business become a very big business?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1232nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friend over there in Monte Carlo who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, it seemed to me that some very big people had it all figured out. But of course, I might be wrong. What I think I saw in the COVID-19 pandemic panic was that some very big businesses figured out how to keep their doors open, while most every small business was forced to close their doors. I saw this when I went to my favorite local garden store at the peak of the panic to buy some plants for the garden, only to find that the store locked up and shut down. I then went to my second favorite local garden store and found it too to be locked up and shut down. No problem, I was told. The big box store is open, but you will have to stand in line and wait your turn. When I tell my little conspiracy theory to friends and associates, many of them roll their eyes and back away. Fine. But the fact is, big business does have many ways of fighting off small business competitors. Most of all of those ways are derived from their economies of scale. Here's how economies of scale work for those businesses. Let's say Farmer Jim has a 1 acre farm, and while neighbor Farmer Jill has a 1,000 acre farm. One day, both Jim and Jill go to town to buy a $10,000 tractor. Now, how much does each farmer pay for that $10,000 tractor? Well, Farmer Jim's tractor costs $10,000 per acre, as he only has 1 acre. Farmer Jill's tractor only costs $10 an acre, because she can spread the $10,000 cost over her 1,000 acres. By understanding this basic economy of scale, the means by which big business competes with small business becomes readily apparent. To further bring light to this competition between big and small, we begin a three-part food chain series we will call Up Against Goliath, with the first episode titled The Bribe. We begin by asking, how does a business bribe its way into becoming a very big business? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Claire Calloway, who is a researcher and a reporter for the Open Markets Institute. Claire, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Now, Open Markets Institute. Now, what exactly is the Open Markets Institute?
Yeah, we're a think tank and advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. that studies issues of corporate power across the economy and promotes the anti-monopoly movement, and I study those issues in food and agriculture.
Okay, good. So here we go. Let me ask you this, but why did you end up with an organization that promotes open markets? It seems like most young people these days are for closed markets, and I think they get well inculcated with the notion of socialism in college. How did you manage to escape that and end up at an Open Markets Institute?
Well, I think the name, you know, it connotates this idea of sort of fair and competitive markets in which there are many buyers. You know, I think, quote unquote, free market ideology has actually led to an economy in which we don't see much semblance of what many economists tout as a healthy market in food and agriculture. Increasingly, you know, farmers, workers have fewer places to sell their products and their labor. We also see large corporations controlling a lot of commerce and sort of setting the terms, in many cases, setting or fixing the prices that farmers receive and that we as consumers pay for food. So it became very clear to me that in the name, again, of quote-unquote free market ideology, we've actually ended up with a lot of very rigged and consolidated unfair markets. And so if alternative food businesses, you know, that aren't solely focused on things like short-term profits or raising share values for investors want to survive, they need a fair playing field and a fair chance to compete, which is something that is increasingly not found in the food sector.
So what you're saying is that free enterprise leads to closed markets in which a very few people benefit greatly and most everybody is pretty much shut out. Is that the...
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. And I found that your writing in Food and Power to be very interesting because what you say, essentially, is that all cafeteria food tastes the same. And why it got to taste the same is very interesting. It's pretty much a perfect example of what you're talking about. So let's take this on. Why does cafeteria food all taste the same, Claire Calloway?
Sure. So, you know, cafeterias at institutions like schools, your business cafeteria, stadiums, a lot of those entities aren't running the cafeteria themselves, not hiring cafeteria staff and buying the food. It is a lot of work. These institutions aren't really in the business of running cafeterias, and so more and more are hiring corporations to manage their cafeterias for them. And it's an industry called food service management. And there are really three large corporations that control most of this industry of outsourcing and managing cafeteria services. There are Aramark, Compass Group, and Sodexo, and they control about 75% over 75% of this industry. And I think these are very large entities that a lot of, you know, they're not consumer facing. Many of their annual revenues rival that of McDonald's, for instance. So these companies buy huge amounts of food, you know, tens of billions a year. And they use their massive purchasing power to strike really lucrative contracts with the companies that provide them food. And it's often big food companies like Pepsi and General Mills and Tyson Foods. They are able to say, you know, if you strike a contract with us to the other pool, you know, all the many locations that they're running cafeterias at, which can be hundreds of different locations across the country, and offer to, purchase large volumes of food from these entities.
So there's some economies of scale going around, right? You have three food service management companies that control 77.5% of the market, which is darn near almost everything, but not quite. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that cook the food. They're the ones that run the cafeteria. They're like professional soldiers of kitchens, I guess. And they control a huge chunk of the marketplace. And they buy their food from several other very big companies that manufacture the food. So you have the big buying food from the big. So that sounds
correct,
like
and
a pretty good deal for all concerns, because that means you can get the price down by buying in bulk. So everybody enjoys the benefits of those economies of scale, except maybe those people who are eating in cafeterias, because all cafeteria food tastes the same. Why is that?
Yeah, I would say this system is actually ends up not being beneficial for almost anyone except the companies involved, because in these contracts, there are provisions that can be very exclusionary to competitors. And over recent years, some of this exclusionary conduct has gotten worse. So,
well, just a sec, when you say exclusionary contracts, what does that mean?
Yeah, so these large cafeteria operators have policies that say they, you know, require all their many locations. So a lot of colleges and universities, for instance, use these companies. Some 80% of colleges and universities have, a large percent, it's like over three quarters, have these entities run their cafeterias. And so Sodexo, for instance, will have, you know, school A and school B all adhere by internal purchasing policies that say you need to buy anywhere from 80 to 100% of all of your food from these vendors that we have set out for you. And these are companies that have negotiated those big purchasing contracts with the colleges. And the reason that they're very set on having all of their chefs at all their different schools and institutions purchase from their preset list of vendors is because those vendors are almost always giving them large cash back rebates on all of their purchases.
Aha. Something tells me we're getting to the bribe.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of in exchange for this large lucrative purchasing contract, Sodexo, Aramark can go to Tyson or a meatpacker like JBS and say, what can you do to sweeten the deal? You know, we're going to promise you a huge volume of purchases. What can you give us in exchange? And often they're offering these volume-based discounts, often called volume discounts allowances or rebates.
Okay, but I'm going to hold this because we want to get back to it after the coming break here. But what we have a situation in which the big are buying food from the big to serve the poor little folks, like those of us who occasionally eat in a cafeteria. And the reason they buy from the big is because they're getting something in return called a kickback. Or, in more common parlance, they're getting bribed. And how does that impact the food we eat? This is the Food Chain, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And today we're eating cafeteria food, which all seems to taste the same no matter which cafeteria you're in. A college cafeteria, a military base cafeteria, a grade school cafeteria, all the food tastes pretty much the same. And there's a reason for that, and the reason for that is the way the economy of a cafeteria works. And here to help explain how that works is Claire Calloway, who is a researcher and reporter with the Open Markets Institute. And I found a wonderful piece that she wrote in Food and Power on the economies of cafeterias and how those cafeterias become dominated by very, very, very big businesses. You said on the range of a McDonald's, is that true? They bring in as much money as McDonald's Corporation?
Yeah, the companies that are hired by many schools and stadiums to run their cafeterias are some very large corporations, yeah, that are bringing in revenues at or around. There's some surpassing those that McDonald's brings in.
So really big companies. They're called food service management companies. And they're essentially they're like professional soldiers that go into a cafeteria and fire up the ovens and cook the food. And so they buy a lot of food. And they buy a lot of food from some very big businesses. And the reason they buy their food from the very specific businesses under exclusionary contracts is that there is a bribe involved. Of course, it's not called a bribe. What is it called, Claire?
Industry will call them volume discounts, off-invoiced rebates, back-end allowances. But I would call them kickbacks. Functionally, what they are, they're some of what the cafeteria company spent on food sent back to them. Again, and this, it can be sent back. Sometimes they're called
So they have all kinds of nice things to say about their bribe or their kickback, but essentially the big food companies are buying the big food service management companies. They're paying them big bucks to buy only from them and not from anybody else. 80 to 100% of their food must come from one big food company. And I suppose when it gets right down to it, that kind of relationship permeates the industrial food chain. So if you are forced to buy your food from, say, Sysco or something like that, Sysco probably goes to its providers and gets the same kind of benefit. Am I wrong?
Yeah, so sometimes these purchasing contracts are struck directly with a big food manufacturer. Sometimes, you mentioned, may also have exclusive distribution with a cafeteria company to sort of deliver all their foods for them. And yes, sometimes distributors will sort of strike these contracts as well with maybe smaller cafeterias or smaller food buyers that don't have the clout to negotiate directly with big food. And yes, the distributors in the middle absolutely, receive their own rebates and benefits from sort of forging these exclusive contracts. They also offer rebates themselves for exclusive contracts to deliver food. So everyone is giving each other take that.
So would we go and eat in a cafeteria then and spend a dollar on some food there, a certain percentage of that is going to be used to bribe the food service management company that bought the food. And probably, I guess it would go all the way up through the food chain. So if you're the chef in charge of a cafeteria and you are told that you must buy food from this company, I suppose that there was a kickback in it for you as well. There must be. And the company that hired that chef would get a kickback from the company from which it bought the food. And I suppose that company that bought the food would get a kickback from the companies that sold them the food and the ones that manufactured the food, so that I wonder, has anybody actually taken a dollar spent in a cafeteria and figured out how much of that dollar would go to kickbacks?
I mean, the system sort of works as you described. I don't think that's quite exactly how it works.
Oh, good. Please correct me.
Yes. So cafeteria companies incentivize their chefs to remain on contract through performance reviews and bonuses. So chefs do receive both professional incentives and financial incentives to, you know, stick with these on-contract purchasing. But, I mean, it's hard to say that that's coming directly out of the revenues that these cafeteria companies are getting from the kickbacks themselves. I mean, I'm sure in part most of the revenues are sort of going, in the case of these very large companies, to the, I guess, purchasing department, sort of the corporate headquarters that is striking these large deals with these purchasing companies. And I guess to your point about how much of sort of the overall net revenues of these cafeteria operators is coming from kickbacks, it is fairly significant. So really, since the 2000s, cafeteria operators, you know, can make money by charging a fee for their services to run the cafeteria at these institutions. And they've actually been sort of holding down those fees and relying more and more on revenue that they're getting from big food companies through these kickbacks. And a report that just came out by an organization called Real Food Generation, which is doing a lot of great research on this and also organizing students at colleges and universities to expose this system and demand for more local food purchasing. Their accounts estimate that as much as 40% of all revenues for, I guess, the North American, net profits, not revenues, for the North American businesses of these large cafeteria operators could be coming from these kickbacks.
Wow, that's a big chunk of the income then, 40% of the net profit. That's huge.
And yes, it's a fundamental part of their business model. You know, you can see where that sort of explicitly ties the fates of these large companies to, you know, buying from big food companies when they're really relying on this revenue as a fundamental part of
their revenues. It's how they make their living and how they stay in business, is by taking bribes or kickbacks. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're not called that. They're called off-balance sheet income or something. You know, you have to figure out something nice to call it, because otherwise it would be called a bribe. And nobody wants to be called a bribe taker, goodness sakes, especially if you're one of the biggest food service management companies in the United States, of which there are only three doing 77.5% of the food, of the cafeteria business in the United States. That's an incredible consolidation. How did the food service management industry become so consolidated, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great question. I mean, I think part of it is there is this pressure to sort of, for all these companies to get bigger so that they can have better negotiating power, striking these big purchasing contracts. You can kind of see how it creates a race for power and a race to get big when your business relies on being able to get a better deal from, again, Pepsi or Tyson Foods or whoever it may be. And you know, there have also certainly been mergers in this space over the several decades. And we see, you know, across the food system, you know, these industries are no exception to a story of consolidation we see happening at almost every level, in which permissive merger policies and permissive antitrust enforcement have really encouraged businesses to sort of compete by getting bigger and by expanding their market share, so they can engage in exactly this kind of, exclusive, anti-competitive behavior.
And it is anti-competitive. But if you're very, very big and it costs, let's say it costs $10,000 to have a government official rule in your favor, if you only have 1 acre, that vote would cost $10,000. But if you had 1,000 acres, then it would only cost $10 per acre. So it wouldn't be a bad deal to, you know, go off and buy yourself a politician or two or three or four. If you can extract all kinds of beneficial rulings in your behavior. Am I wrong?
No, yes, certainly we see this concentration of economic power absolutely translates into political power that's used for large corporations across the food system of all types to write rules of the game that fundamentally advantage their businesses over others.
There you go. Well, let's talk about how that consolidation and how those economies of scale and how all of the bribes impact what we eat at the cafeteria. So the students, you wrote about in Food and Power, you wrote about how the students at the University of Utah decided to try to see if they could get local food to be included at the cafeteria of the University of Utah. So what happened?
Yeah, so we see the students at the University of Utah are an example of a movement of student organizing to try and leverage the huge amount of money that's flowing through these colleges and universities to support local businesses. And they worked with their dining services to create a questionnaire that they could take out to local farms and food businesses to ask really, frankly, granular and specific details about, you know, their delivery and their food safety and essentially their qualifications and capacity to potentially serve the university. And a lot of these food businesses, you know, were very excited about the opportunity, and it took several months, you know, to work back and forth and fill out what I understand was a pretty, you know, professional and lengthy questionnaire. And the students were, you know, really excited after having gathered all this information and identified some local businesses that really seemed to have the to, you know, sell to the university. But when they approached their dining services with this list, they were told that it would be impossible to do business with any producer that didn't already have that wasn't already distributed with and had a business relationship with Sysco, which was the food distributor that was providing all the products to the university, basically the one-stop shop that the dining services was buying all of their food from. And again, as we're talking about, Sysco is a huge national food distributor. It's both challenging to get a spot on their warehouse shelves, and it's challenging for any of these, you know, food businesses to get a meeting with the, you know, larger buyer of food for Sodexo, not to be confused with Sysco. Sodexo, the company, Compass Group, which again is one of these big three food management companies. Compass Group was running the cafeteria at University of Utah.
So you're going to hold that spot right there because we want to come back to it because it's really relevant as to why cafeteria food tastes the same all over the world, which is bland. And there's a reason for that. And we will learn about that reason from Claire Calloway, who is a researcher and writer for Open Markets Institute. And how did open markets become closed markets? Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, the students at the University of Utah tried to figure out how to do it otherwise, other than the big bribe industry of food service management and food manufacturers. They tried to figure out how to get local farm produce into the foods being offered at the University of Utah cafeteria. But after going through all that hard work of surveying the market and figuring out where the farmers were and figuring out what kinds of food they had to offer and going through all of that, they ran up against Sysco, which is the big food manufacturer, I guess, the big food wholesaler that sells to the Compass Group, which is the food service management company that runs the University of Utah cafeteria. And they said, no. No little boys or girls allowed. We just do business with the big boys. And the reason we do business with the big boys is because that's how we make a big chunk of our money. 40-50% of our money comes from kickbacks and bribes from big boys. Now, why would we want little boys and girls to participate in this food chain? Is that a fair summation, Claire?
Yeah, no, I would say that happened. I mean, and I guess to also explain, you know, some people might ask, well, couldn't these local businesses have a relationship with Sysco, the food distributor that sells to the University of Utah? Or couldn't they, you know, get joined the network of Compass Group? And, you know, it is just almost impossible for these small businesses to get a seat at the table when they're trying to negotiate, you know, a purchasing contract with these big national buyers. And so, you know, they need to sort of get into the system to get onto students' plates. And they just don't have that opportunity purely, you know, because of their size. And because they probably can't offer, they don't have lots of deep pockets to offer hefty kickbacks.
Yeah, they don't have the economies of scale to make that $10,000 gift to their favorite politician or to their favorite food service management broker. And so they're left out in the cold. And that has a lot to do with why cafeteria food tastes the way cafeteria food tastes. What kind of foods do the big food manufacturers and brokers sell to the big food service management companies? They certainly don't sell fresh local produce for reasons we have just covered. What do they sell?
Yeah, so again, to go back to this report by the Real Food Generation, they spoke with a former manager at a cafeteria for Sodexo in Colorado, and I think he said it best. He said there's big money tied up in big company food and agribusiness. There's not a lot of money tied up in fresh vegetables and fruits. And it's true, we see large companies that are able to offer these rebates, you know, dish disproportionately are dealing in pre-prepared, frozen, packaged, shelf-stable goods, and that encourages greater volumes of, yeah, purchases of those processed foods over things like fresh fruits and vegetables.
Now, there are some that try to get out from underneath that bland cafeteria food. The University of Vermont tried to do so by doing some product specification buying, which is, what's that? Claire Calloway?
Right. So, you know, obviously it can seem really challenging to sort of circumvent these deals that seem like they're made, you know, centralized between one big corporation and another. At the same time, you know, these cafeteria operators sort of serve to exist the institutions that are hiring them. And there is some power that an institution like a University of Vermont can have in saying, if you want the contract to serve our food, we're going to write in some specifications about, you know, what we want in that contract. And that is a really powerful place for institutions to insert their values, you know, into that contract, to say, you know, we really believe as an institution in supporting the local economy, in supporting, you know, humane animal products and supporting environmentally sound products. And so they can say, if you want to serve food for us, you're going to have to abide by these product specifications, and then have the food service management company sort of work to meet those requirements. And that's a way that some institutions have been able to promote more local and responsible food.
So the university says, well, we believe in good food. We believe in fresh local food. We believe in supporting our local community. We want to have good food for our students so they'll be bright and smart and intelligent. And so they tell the big food service management companies, if you want to serve us, this is what you have to serve us. So how long does that last? I mean, this, you know, you try to do something, but unless you're standing there watching over the situation 24/7, 365, I would suspect the bribes would come back in to play, and the food service management company would start sliding back into their old ways, by which they made a lot of money. Am I wrong?
Certainly the system requires a lot of oversight. And there's been major issues in the past, you know, with, for instance, where public schools may be hiring these companies to manage their food, when, you know, the cafeteria company isn't sharing the money that they got back from a big food company. They're essentially, you know, pilfering public dollars. They paid for something like 800 cases of chicken breast with taxpayer money. They got a certain percent cash back, and they kept it. You know, really that money should be shared back with the school district. And that's a place where these companies are technically required to do that, but they've been caught of keeping that money for themselves. And both the Attorney General of New York State and also of D.C. have reached huge multi-million dollar settlements with these companies for not sharing that money. And so that's just one example of the need for enforcement and oversight of this industry, and one also the need to, you know, really audit the invoices and for individual institutions to, you know, really look at what are these companies buying, and yeah, and ensure that there's, again, transparency.
Well, I'm simply shocked shocked, I tell you, that a company would do such a thing, but I suppose it does happen. Well, are bribes illegal? Is this an illegal practice that we see? I mean, it would seem to be, but maybe not.
If
a food service management company puts their business out to bid, and, you know, you have three different distributors, you know, pitching that business, I would suspect the issue of kickbacks or bribes or whatever they're called would come up in the negotiations. Are those legal?
Right. So volume, a bulk discount, for instance, is legal and in many cases sensible. You know, bulk discounts can represent genuine savings, you know, for instance, saying, look, I can commit to buying, you know, five boxes every week instead of one. And that means that you can fit a product into a shipment and save on shipping costs. You know, sometimes bulk purchases represent genuine savings and it makes sense to give discounts there. But what is not allowed under antitrust law is when these discounts are, you know, exceptionally large and distort the market and keep other players out. And they're also not allowed when they're tied to this exclusive agreement. So saying, you know, I can give you this sweet discount if you commit to buy a certain percentage. So when you're committing to buying a certain portion of all of your chicken or soda from just my company, that is exclusive dealing and that is not allowed. What is not clear, is it's probably unlikely that that agreement is written into these contracts, but it's almost a de facto exclusive agreement because all of these cafeteria companies have internal corporate policies that their locations need to buy 80 to 100% of their foods from approved vendors. And so it's understood, you know, between both parties that that's the way these businesses operate and that's what you're getting when you strike a purchasing contract with them. And so this could be the loophole, but on its face, and what ends up happening, you know, is not allowed.
So that was really interesting. Let me see if I can grab on to that. When a cafeteria food service management company negotiates an exclusionary contract with a food broker, you must buy 80 to 100% of your food from me. I will pay you this money, this kickback. I'll give you all this money for doing that. But you can't buy your food from anybody else. Now, that sounds like your definition of an illegal kickback.
But it isn't. These contracts are very, very secretive. And, you know, I've been reporting on this issue and I have never seen them. They're very secretive. And so.
Well, I can see why.
Yes.
Because you're admitting to bribing and taking bribes.
If that's in the contract.
If it's in the contract.
I think these large companies have, you know, lawyers and strong counsel. I don't think they would be that explicit to do that, but I don't know. It's very secretive. And so it is, though, understood that one party has, you know, this corporate policy to buy in a certain way. And so when you're striking a purchasing contract with them, you know, some things, I guess, are understood.
Wow. So that's a very interesting. Are we doomed to have this perpetual big getting bigger by virtue of their economies of scale to until we get to there's just one big company that does everything? Or is it just my imagination? It sure looks that it's heading that way.
Certainly, consolidation has only continued to increase on many levels of the food system, even when, you know, it's not clear. A lot of this concentration has been done in the name of saving money. But you reach a certain point where companies get so big that they can coordinate these deals, and it's not always clear that they're saving money anymore. You know, in the case of these rebates, for instance, sometimes a food seller, again, say like a chip company, will actually mark up the price that they're charging the school to factor in the rebate, and then, you know, they'll get it afterwards. So they're actually, you know, sometimes increasing the cost of food. And we also see across the economy companies colluding to increase prices paid to consumers. And yes.
And when there's only three companies, it would seem to be a lot easier to do the colluding than if there are a bunch of companies.
Absolutely. Yes. And this is something that we've seen, you know, every major meatpacking company, for instance, or every major industry from chicken to pork to tuna, is currently under some type of either federal investigation or a private allegation of
impropriety.
Price fixing.
Claire Kellaway, thank you so much for joining us today, researcher and reporter for Open Markets Institute and writing in Food and Power. Thank you so much, Claire, for joining us, and thank you all out there for tuning in. Remember that Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. And now you know why. Thank you, Claire.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.